This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to the world today. G'day, I'm Sally Sara. This Wednesday, the Defence Force ready to roll into aged care facilities as the crisis in the sector deepens. And why some Labor MPs want to help the government get its controversial religious discrimination laws through Parliament before it becomes an election issue. Well, first up today, there's some confronting new research that's been released revealing that 1 in 10 Australian healthcare workers has had thoughts of suicide or self-harm during the pandemic. Most didn't seek help. The study gives a stark insight into the pressures faced by those who take care of us, including nuclear medicine technologist Georgina Lonergan.
Some days are better than others. There's an undercurrent of anxiety, I think, for everyone working in healthcare. I've definitely had an undercurrent of anxiety increasing over the last couple of years. Some days you just really don't want to come. There's been a couple of days where I've been close to tears on the way in just from anxiety and just being tired of it all. Pretty much everyone I work with has had anxiety increasing over the last couple of years. But to know that 1 in 10 of the surveyed healthcare workers have had either suicidal ideation or thoughts of self-harm, that's really upsetting. I've had some health issues in the past. I've had cancer twice. And, you know, those two periods of my life were highly unpleasant, but they had an end date. The pandemic, because it's been so ongoing and there's really no end in sight, that's what makes it so hard.
That's the voice of one health professional. That's a nuclear medicine technologist, Georgina Lonergan, in Victoria. Well, almost 8,000 health professionals have completed this survey. It's part of the Australian Frontline Healthcare Workers Study, and it's been published in the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry. The lead author is Professor Marie Bismark from the Centre for Health Policy at the University of Melbourne.
As far as we know, this is the largest study in the world of suicidal thoughts among healthcare workers, and it's particularly important that our study include healthcare workers from all roles and professions. So some previous research overseas has looked at doctors and nurses, but our study also included allied health practitioners, support staff, cleaners, all the people who make the hospital system and healthcare system work.
What does this study tell us about the prevalence of suicidal thoughts or self-harm amongst health workers who've been in the thick of it in the pandemic?
We found that 1 in 10 healthcare workers in Australia during the pandemic reported thoughts of suicide or self-harm in the previous 2 weeks. Those are really alarming statistics. Even before the pandemic, healthcare workers had higher rates of suicide than people in other occupations. But it does seem that that has become worse with the pandemic.
What does that tell you about the kind of pressures that health workers have been under during the pandemic?
I'm a health worker myself, and I can tell you that we are exhausted. One of the striking findings in our study was that among the healthcare workers with thoughts of suicide or self-harm, 90% of them described emotional exhaustion, which is one of the components of burnout. But even among the other health workers, 70% of them were describing emotional exhaustion.
What do we see in terms of the number of healthcare workers who are prepared to step forward and try and get some help if they're in trouble like that?
One of the most worrying findings from our study was that among the healthcare workers with thoughts of suicide or self-harm, fewer than half of them sought any kind of professional help. Some of them said that even though they were really struggling with their mental health, they just didn't have the time or energy to get help, that they would come home from the hospital absolutely exhausted, and trying to access care for themselves felt like another thing on their to-do list that they just didn't have the energy for. In our study, we saw that younger healthcare workers were better at help seeking than some of the older healthcare workers. So I really hope that we're beginning to see some cultural changes. It can be difficult to access care. Many of your listeners will know how hard it's been to access a psychologist or to access mental health support during the pandemic, and that's equally true for healthcare workers themselves.
What do we know about what can happen to the standard of patient care if health professionals remain under significant mental health stress?
When healthcare workers are struggling with their own mental health, it can have real implications for patient care. We know that people who are profoundly depressed are more likely to make mistakes or errors in their work. So our results matter a great deal for healthcare workers and the people who love them, but they also have really profound implications for the quality of patient care.
What's the message for the community from this study when we're quantifying the amount of stress that's been placed on health workers?
I think that this study sounds alarm bells that we're not doing enough to care for the people who have been caring for us throughout the pandemic. I was working as a doctor at the Royal Melbourne Hospital when I was doing this study, and as the results started to come through, it gave me chills down my spine to walk around the hospital and to see my colleagues who had a smile on their face, who were doing everything they could to help the patients in our hospital, and to know from this study that 1 in 10 of them was struggling in a really profound way with their own mental health. I think healthcare workers in general are very, very good at putting on a brave face, getting on with the job, placing the needs of patients first. And I think it's time that we recognise how much healthcare workers have been struggling through the pandemic and give them the care that they need and deserve.
That's Professor Marie Bismark there from the Centre for Health Policy at the University of Melbourne, talking about this new research about the mental health effects of the pandemic on healthcare workers who are taking care of others. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Well, for those working in hospitals, in doctors' surgeries and in ambulances and elsewhere across the country, many of them say they're not surprised by the findings of this study. For many healthcare workers, the past 2 years have been some of the most difficult times of their life. Isabel Rowe reports.
For the past 2 years, Georgina Lonergan's life has been ruled by anxiety.
For the first part of the pandemic, it was the fear of the unknown because it was all just unfolding and none of us really knew what was happening or how bad it was going to get. And then the last year, it's just been the ongoing anxiety of coming into a hospital and a workplace that is full of really sick people that have a potentially deadly communicable disease.
She's a nuclear medicine technologist at a Victorian hospital. She uses medical imaging to help diagnose disease. Every day involves working in hot, restrictive personal protective gear and carries the fear of catching and spreading COVID-19.
Some days you just really don't want to come. There's been a couple of days where I've been close to tears on the way in just from anxiety and just being tired of it all. And then some days, you know, you wake up okay and come into work and it's fine.
The survey of 8,000 healthcare workers during the second wave of the pandemic found 1 in 10 had thoughts about suicide or self-harm in the past 2 weeks. Most of the respondents were from Victoria. Georgina Lonergan knows it's been hard for all of her colleagues, but she didn't realise the extent of it.
That's really upsetting. We all work in healthcare because we want to help people and we all really do love our jobs, otherwise you just wouldn't do it.
Has this been the hardest period of your working life?
It has been. I've had some health issues in the past. I've had cancer twice, but they had an end date. And the pandemic, when is it going to end? None of us really know.
In New South Wales, paramedic and health services union delegate Tess Oxley isn't surprised by the survey.
My mental health definitely has taken a massive hit over the last 12 months. However, I've never, thankfully, felt that I've sunk that low. There's definitely been colleagues that we've been concerned about and that we've had to watch a little bit more closely than others. Whether or not that was how low they felt, I don't know. But there were serious concerns about some of my workmates.
What was it about the work that you've been doing that has taken such a toll on people?
I think there was the fatiguing nature of it. And there was the fact that this is probably for the first time for a lot of us. It almost felt like we were taking our work home with us. We didn't get a reprieve. So all of the fears and all of the stress that we're facing at work, we're facing that in our everyday lives as well. So it was like a 24/7 bombardment that we just couldn't escape.
She says the stress of the pandemic was compounded by staffing issues that existed before 2020.
And what they need to do now is say, yeah, you're right. We need to put these systems into place. We need proper staff support systems. We need to have resourcing that allows staff to have breaks, that doesn't force staff to take extended overtime.
For many healthcare professionals, speaking publicly or asking for help with that stress doesn't just carry a stigma. There's a concern about having it reported to the medical board. Dr. Karen Price is the president of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners.
Well, there's a bit of a fear that's perhaps overplayed here, because on speaking to the head of the medical board, Professor Anne Tonkin, she has suggested that the APRA is there to protect the public from impaired practitioners. But if a practitioner is help seeking, then they're pretty okay with that. If a GP or junior doctor or nurse or paramedic is seeking help, that's a signal that they've got some insight and are getting appropriate care. So they're not as interested in that as someone who's continuing to power through but having no insight that they are impaired. As doctors, nurses, paramedics, we see things and deal with things every day that most people never get to see. You know, we see terrible things, we see trauma, we see children dying. There is some degree to a need to build resilience, but it may not be through stoicism. It may be through supporting each other.
Dr. Price says being prepared, like replenishing national stockpiles of PPE for health professionals, will prevent some of that stress in the next pandemic.
That's Isabel Rowe reporting there. Well, members of the Australian Defence Force are expected to arrive in aged care homes from today as severe staff shortages continue and the COVID death toll among the elderly keeps growing. 200 ADF personnel heading to Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland and South Australia to offer clinical, logistical and other support. But the families of some older Australians in aged care say that it's too little, too late. Stephanie Smale reports.
Queensland has suffered its worst day yet during the pandemic. 24 people have died of COVID, 16 of those in aged care. Dozens of facilities are affected. The worst hit Jetta Gardens at Logan, south of Brisbane, where 15 people have died during an outbreak within the centre. Families are fearing the worst for their relatives. Mark, which isn't his real name, says his mother lives there. He says she hasn't had a booster shot and has contracted COVID-19.
Fortunately, she's well and she's doing good, but there were many times where she found herself in her room. She says she sometimes calls out for people and there's no people showing up for her.
There have been severe staff shortages at the Sydney aged care facility where Jan Foster's mother is living too. She says her mother has lost weight because she's not getting enough help with eating and had a fall trying to get to the toilet.
It's really distressing for residents when they end up having to, you know, urinate in their pads. My mother, she's quite good cognitively, and I know that that has occurred. You know how distressing that can be.
Jan Foster says staff are doing their best and she's relieved all of the residents at her mother's Sydney care facility have now had their booster. But she says the evidence of COVID's toll is clear.
I've seen several ambulances leaving the facility and I have seen families there, you know, taking their loved ones' belongings away.
About 200 Australian Defence Force personnel will be available to lend a hand in the aged care sector from today, some offering clinical assistance, others general help or support with logistics. But without better wages and working conditions for aged care staff, Jan Foster says long-term staff shortages will persist.
You know, it's putting a band-aid over a huge wound.
The union that represents aged care workers says the ADF deployment is too little too late. Carolyn Smith is the National Aged Care Director for the United Workers Union.
Almost 3 weeks ago, providers and unions called for the ADF in aged care because of the crisis that was going on right there and then. It seems like 2 years into the pandemic, the government knew the problems in aged care but didn't have a plan. And 2 years into the pandemic, the government did not want to admit that there was a crisis in aged care.
She says there is hope the worst of the staff shortages are likely to be easing, but systemic understaffing issues aren't going away.
Many medical specialists tell us there will be more waves of COVID, more variants of COVID. So whilst there is some short-term relief, it doesn't fix the long-term systemic issues in aged care that we're seeing play out during this pandemic.
That's Caroline Smith there from the United Workers Union, ending that report from Stephanie Smale. On ABC Radio, right across the country, and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Well, to Canberra now, where both major parties are in deep discussion today about how they'll deal with the controversial religious discrimination bill. The government wants to pass the legislation as soon as possible, but it's facing resistance from some moderate Liberals, meaning its passage is far from certain. Meanwhile, the opposition is meeting to try to formalise its position. Our reporter James Glenday is following all of the events for us at Parliament House. James, what's Labor's position likely to be?
So the opposition's meeting at the moment to thrash out concerns. That meeting's probably likely to stop and start throughout today to give everyone a chance to express their views. And the indications that I have received this morning is that what Labor would like to do is look at supporting the bill, but with amendments to water down some of the more controversial aspects of the legislation. Now, to do that, in the lower house, they'd need the support of Liberal moderates, and there are about five of those who have really substantial concerns. But some of those moderates, though, are worried about the optics of working with the opposition so close to an election and what that might mean for the government. And so what might end up happening, in fact, I think probably what's the most likely outcome as things stand, is that if the amendments fail in the lower house, the bill gets passed, goes to the Senate for a big fight over the amendments again there, given that the government doesn't control the numbers in the upper house. And one moderate is Dave Sharma. He represents Malcolm Turnbull's old seat in Sydney. He is remaining very tight-lipped about what he is going to do.
I'm not going to telegraph in advance what I might or might not do. It really depends on how discussions go and debate proceeds over the next day or two. But I do have these concerns. They're deeply held.
That's the member for Wentworth there, Dave Sharma. And James Glenday, that's where the political machinations stand, but what will it mean if these laws are passed?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, because this so often gets lost in the forest. People are sort of too focused on the trees. This bill aims to ensure a person cannot be discriminated against on the basis of their faith or indeed their lack of faith. And there's debate about whether religion in Australia actually needs that explicit discrimination act as a shield, but there is widespread agreement in Parliament that, yep, that is a fair enough aim. Where the controversy begins, though, is the scope of the bill and the extent to which religion should be able to be used as a reason to discriminate against others. For example, this bill would protect genuinely held statements of belief, and gay rights advocates opposed to the law say that could theoretically allow a man to say to a female employee that women should not hold leadership roles, or for a nurse to say to an HIV patient that their condition is a punishment from the Lord. And that makes a lot of moderate politicians very uncomfortable. The current package of laws will also ensure that gay students can't be expelled from religious schools, but as we discussed yesterday, trans students won't be initially protected. And the whole tone of the recent debate has quite a few people worried, even cabinet ministers worried. The Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, this morning expressed her concerns.
I don't think that the debate is particularly nuanced, to be frank. I think the debate is being held at peak volume and on social media. I'm not sure that that helps, but that is what we have to deal with.
That's the Foreign Minister there, Maurice Payne. And James, what are the likely political consequences if the bill doesn't pass?
It's an interesting question. There are a lot of people in Parliament who think on a day-to-day level that they don't really believe that this act is going to be used particularly often. And a lot of people in the opposition think that the timing of this debate, just out from an election, last sitting days of Parliament vibe, is deliberately an attempt to wedge the Labor Party and an opportunity for the Prime Minister to try to portray it it as opposed to Christian or even Australian values or as part of a broader culture war if Labor decides to shoot this bill down. And there are a lot of marginal seats that have substantial faith groups and communities in them. On the other side, you've got Christian lobby groups that are very unhappy where things sit. They were unhappy with the legalisation of same-sex marriage. They're targeting moderate Liberals at the moment, trying to stop them changing the bill anymore. For example, the Australian Christian lobby this morning claimed that if moderate Liberals vote for these amendments, then they are supporting Anthony Albanese as their leader. But I guess to answer the precise question, the timing is really interesting because a lot of MPs don't think this is a big vote changer either way, and even more, just don't actually think this should be a real focus for the Parliament given the crisis in aged care we just heard about and also the broader pandemic-related problems the country is grappling with.
And James, just briefly, we're keeping watch as well on the National Press Club. Former Liberal staffer Brittany Higgins and former Australian of the Year Grace Tame will be speaking.
Yeah, and a lot of people are nervously eyeing what's happening down the road here at Parliament today, watching what's happening at the Press Club, because we're expecting in particular that Brittany Higgins will respond to the apology yesterday and also talk about what needs to be done to improve the culture in Canberra. This morning, the Finance Minister introduced some legislation to further act on recommendations to improve the parliamentary workplace. It's going to be fascinating to hear what these two women have to say about the Coalition's efforts in this area so far.
A very important joint address at the National Press Club. James Glenday at Parliament House, thank you. Well, finally today, the head of Australia's largest bank believes its home loan customers are well prepared to weather possible interest rate rises. The Commonwealth Bank has posted an improved half-year profit of $4.7 billion. Its chief executive, Matt Comyn, also thinks Australia's economy is in a good position to bounce back from the pandemic. He spoke with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Well, Matt Comyn, just to the economy, how confident are you that we've seen the worst of the pandemic and that the recovery will continue?
Well, as confident as we can be. Clearly, January itself was a difficult month, but already we've seen a recovery in spend coming back later in the month, and February's looking strong. As you would have seen from our results update, we're very optimistic about the outlook for the Australian economy over calendar 22 and 23.
We've seen the damage from Omicron just this year, but how prepared are you for a new variant?
Well, look, I think very well prepared. And of course, we're all hoping that Omicron is the sort of dominant strain for some time, but we're certainly not ruling out any further strains or, you know, obviously other things that may go wrong from time to time.
You talk about a bright future in your outlook, but you must be just a little bit cautious about declaring the emergency is over.
Yes, that's right. But I mean, we can only observe from what we're seeing in terms of economic conditions. We think there's a very strong, more than $250 billion consumer surplus that we believe households will spend over the next couple of years. And I think it's quite remarkable that we sit here today after 2 years of a pandemic with the lowest unemployment rate in 13 years.
The Prime Minister and Treasurer are busy claiming credit for strong economic management during the pandemic, but do they deserve all the credit given the measures or the rescue measures that banks took at the height of the pandemic?
Yes, we certainly would like to think that the banking industry has played an important role in terms of unprecedented levels of support for our customers. But it's also a credit to Australians and Australian businesses about how resilient they've been over those 2 years and how they've been able to adapt to very difficult circumstances.
That's a long way away from April 2020 when the CBA had that extreme scenario that real estate values might fall by more than 30%.
Well, I think, as you said, at that point in time, I think we were all collectively staring into the abyss. And fortunately, we haven't seen anything like that materialise. And I think to our great surprise, and it's a huge credit, the economy has bounced back much faster, both domestically and globally.
Your economics team at the CBA see the first Reserve Bank rate rise in August this year. And even though the rate cycle will probably be gentle, are you concerned that highly indebted households will be able to withstand that?
We've obviously looked very closely at our lending book and feel very confident about our customers' ability to make repayments in a slightly higher interest rate environment.
Do you have many customers left on the loan repayment deferrals?
No, we don't. We've got, I think, more than 92% of customers customers have come out entirely of deferrals, as you would appreciate. We're getting down to smaller, much smaller numbers from where we were. But clearly, there are still some sectors of the economy that have been impacted.
Will the CBA and other banks be helped by rate rises?
You know, slightly higher cash rate environment definitely helps. I mean, overall, as I've said before, you know, the Commonwealth Bank does well when the Australian economy does well.
Your provision for bad loans in the half is down significantly, but what sort of buffer do you still have to deal with household or business stress from bad loans?
We have about a $2 billion surplus to the central economic scenario based on everything that we can see. So clearly a pretty substantial level of provisioning, as you said. That's been it's a huge positive, and clearly that's helped our overall result for the half.
That's Commonwealth Bank Chief Executive Matt Common speaking with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Well, that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. Plenty happening. The PM team will be along this evening with the latest analysis of what's unfolding across the country and around the globe. Thanks for your company. We'll be back same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily Podcast. As international travellers are welcomed back to Australia, the West Australian Premier is standing firm, defending his decision to keep the borders closed indefinitely. Today, we speak to two WA businessmen about the impact of working in a fortress state. Look for ABC News Daily on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.